This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an update on the status of the Cuban Five case. Attorney Marty Garbus, who joined the case 2 years ago, tells us about two motions that are being made. One, exposing the efforts of the American government to bribe journalists to write slanted stories before and during the trial of the Cuban Five. And secondly, on the NSA spying on the attorneys when they spoke with their clients.
We'll talk with Horace Campbell and his new book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya.
Campbell destroys what many progressives considered a just war.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, 2 weeks ago, Judge Loretta Preska sentenced Jeremy Hammond to the maximum 10 years, according to the terms of his plea agreement. Were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed and dismayed and outraged, but I wasn't surprised. Judge Preska is not known for exactly being a liberal on the court, on the conservative side of it. She treated this case very harshly from the beginning, denying Jeremy any kind of bail, rushing ahead on the sentencing even, and she gave that 10-year sentence, even despite the fact there were an incredible set of letters supporting Jeremy Hammond, supporting the fact that we're in this incredible moment of an information war and who's going to control the internet and who's going to control secrecy and dirty tricks. And people were very supportive of Jeremy Hammond, everybody from Daniel Ellsberg to people who used his material from the Stratfor leaks, which is the private intelligence company, people who used that material. 15 newspapers, I think, came into court and said, we support Jeremy Hammond. He should get time served. What he released, the Stratfor emails, were very, very valuable. Despite that, the judge gave him the 10 years and then gave him 3 additional years of supervised probation. And while I don't have that in front of me at the moment, it includes a ban on any use of encryption, a ban on hiding his identity on the internet, and I don't recall the exact words, but it's something like a ban on any association with groups involved in civil disobedience. Now, this is after the judge already said, you're not a Martin Luther King, you're not that kind of civil disobedient person, and yet she bans him from any group involved in civil disobedience. They may just advocate it. It's a crazy thing, but it shows you, two things show you how worried the governments are about people like Jeremy Hammond and people who want free information and want a democratic internet and don't want private intelligence, and how worried they are about civil disobedience and groups taking to the streets. It's incredible they put a ban like that on him. So he has this very severe sentence. He has this post-ban for 3 years, very, very harsh. And I want to put it just for a moment in context because, of course, he did plead guilty to one count of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That carried a maximum of 10 years. She didn't have to give him the maximum. He's done 20 months in jail already. He'll get credit for that, but he's still going to do a very, very long time. She could have given him much less time or time served. At the same time, that's the act that was used to prosecute or persecute Aaron Swartz, who, when he was facing 35 years in prison under that act, took his own life. That's the act that is being used against Barrett Brown, a number of other people involved in this universe of free information and making sure the government doesn't protect its illegal activities with broad secrecy assertions. So it was an outrageous sentence, both in terms of his individual case, in terms of his support, and really has to be seen in the context of an incredible crackdown.
It was a 10-year sentence for a young man. What is he, Michael, 26?
He's 28.
10 years.
Two individuals who had committed similar actions in Great Britain were given time served. So that does highlight what a punitive country we've become in terms of, as you say, information control.
I think that's a really important point, Heidi. That was one of the key points, I think, that was talked about in the sentencing, that others who did the exact same act, part of LulzSec or Anonymous, whatever the group was, basically got time served. So this country has gotten incredibly punitive. I mean, put in the context of Chelsea Manning and 35 years for revealing the dirty, rotten illegalities of our war machine.
But there's an exception, though, Michael. They're punitive when it comes to people like Jeremy Hammond. But when it comes to the banksters who stole billions of dollars from people and actually caused them to lose their homes, they don't get 10 years in prison.
Well, and I think the issue that brings us all together is the fact that Jeremy and Barrett Brown were outspoken in exposing the issue of corporate collusion with the government in conducting intelligence.
You know, that's really important. I mean, you know, people think, you know, we sue the government all the time for spying, and you're very involved, obviously, in government surveillance, and your new book, of course, called
Spying on Democracy,
talks a lot about what corporations do. And what Jeremy and Barrett Brown were exposing was the fact, really, that 70 to 80% of all intelligence gathered in the United States is by private corporations, many of them, much of it in contract to places like the NSA and other government agencies.
Exactly. And Barrett's alleged crime was basically uploading a link to a lot of that information, and he's facing 105 years in federal prison.
Say the full name of your book.
Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance, which is hopefully something that people will continue to do in the light of these punitive sentences.
One last point. This judge is a Federalist Society judge. She sits on the bench about six blocks from Wall Street. She was a partner in a Wall Street law firm, as is her husband. I think her husband is a managing partner, and that firm was hacked by Jeremy. This judge had no business taking the case. There was an obvious, not just an appearance of a conflict of interest, but a real conflict of interest. She wouldn't give this case up. She wouldn't let Jeremy out on bail so he could prepare his own defense. And she was determined from the beginning to put him in jail for a long, long time. She succeeded in doing that. She wrote her sentencing decision before she even heard Sarah Kunstler speak out on behalf of Jeremy.
Okay, I think our last segment on this, Hedy Boghossian is going to read us some of Sarah Kunstler's
sentencing argument.
It's
difficult to pick the parts of this because it's such an excellent written document, but I'll start with the opening paragraphs and then read a couple of others. In December of 2012, 24,000 geophysicists gathered at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union. The most well-attended lecture was about the depletion of the Earth's resources. A geophysicist named Brad Werner from the University of California walked the crowd through an advanced computer model to show how the rapid depletion of these resources was leading to the destabilization of the Earth's ability to sustain human life.
Sarah told me to say that those first couple of paragraphs were sort of cribbed a little bit from the well-known writer Naomi Klein.
And I'm sure Naomi wouldn't mind us using them. When asked what could reverse or stem this tide, Mr. Werner was largely at a loss. There was one dynamic in the model, however, that offered some hope. Werner termed it resistance, movements of, quote, people or groups of people who adopt a certain set of dynamics that does not fit within the dominant culture. According to the abstract for his presentation, this includes, quote, protests, blockades, and sabotage by indigenous peoples, workers, and other activist groups. So Sarah then goes on to say that it's rare that serious scientific gatherings call for mass political resistance, and she puts this in historical context. And then she goes on to say, the development and use of surveillance technologies will be one of the defining issues of our times. The reach of these capabilities is astonishingly broad. Governments can listen in on cell phone calls, use voice recognition to scan mobile networks, read emails and text messages, censor web pages, track a citizen's every movement using GPS, and even can change email contents while en route to a recipient. Now, she then says, Jeremy Hammond, a gifted computer programmer, decided to use his skills to break the law. He did so out of a concern that these technologies were enabling governments and corporations to gather information on individuals and organizations without oversight or scrutiny. He did so as an act of protest. And as a result of his actions and the actions of others similarly committed to open government, the public has become increasingly aware and increasingly concerned. She then talks about how members of the U.S. Attorney's office don't accept Jeremy's acts as acts of civil disobedience and who see them as one-dimensional, criminal, and malicious. Then she says, if Jeremy spent every waking hour online, hiding behind a screen, hacking into websites, it would lend credence to the government's argument. But this is not the case. Jeremy Hammond lived an active, moral, and productive offline life as well. A life in which he was devoted to helping others, in the same way that many of us imagine we would do if only we had the time. In an age where technology and computers isolate us, where we walk around staring into tiny screens, use social media to stay in touch with friends, and send text messages rather than talk to people in our lives, Jeremy connected with people, looked into their eyes, and made an impact on their lives in extraordinarily positive ways. The government ignores the letters of support we received. 60 out of a total of 265 from people who know Jeremy from his positive work in the communities of Chicago, people who have firsthand knowledge of the countless hours he devoted to volunteering, teaching, tutoring, creating a community space so groups could meet, organizing to close down local coal plants that were poisoning his neighbors, helping people gain skills, find jobs, and get back on their feet, opening the doors of his home to people who were hungry and in need, and inspiring others to do these same things. I just want to read one example before we close. One of the most wonderful letters attached to our submission came from someone who had never met Jeremy, a father of two young children attending college in Chicago, who wrote after his children made him aware of Jeremy's case. This man's children were not friends of Jeremy's either. He happened to run into them on the street when they were moving their belongings up three flights of stairs into a new apartment. Jeremy happened by and offered to help. Later...
Heidi, tearing up. I have to, because we're on the radio, you can't see okay. Heidi.
Later, after his arrest, they saw his picture on the news and realized that the person who had helped them was the person who now awaits sentence in this case. And then, after Sarah read this, the judge gave him 10 years.
Heidi, thank you for that really moving reading. Last word, Jeremy has been moved from the MDC in southern Manhattan to MDC in Brooklyn. You can go to the freejeremy.net website if you want to write him, send him things, etc. But that prison in Brooklyn is only a temporary site. He will be eventually moved to a federal prison somewhere in the country. The one thing the judge said, she'd like him to be near Chicago where his family is. Let's hope the Federal Bureau of Prisons listens to that.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice.
We're joined today by prominent constitutional attorney Martin Garbus to get an update on the Cuban Five case. Marty joined the case of the Cuban Five last year and has concentrated his efforts in two areas. One is to expose how the United States government paid journalists to write slanted articles against the Cuban Five before and during the trial, and most immediately, to expose the fact that the NSA had spied on the conversations and meetings between the Cuban Five and their attorneys. Marty Garbus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
Hi, Marty. Well, it's really good to be able to talk to you. As our listeners may know, you have taken a part now in the Cuban Five case the original appellate attorney, our good friend Len Wineglass, passed away. And the torch has been passed to you, Marty, and
right.
You've been litigating it now. Of course, the Cuban Five are in prison, four of them. One of them got out, but the other four have been in prison now for, I think, 14 years. And I wanted to ask you, in a nutshell, to give our listeners a description of what happened to them and how they were framed up and why, and then go to the essence of our interview, which is the current state of the litigation. So first let me ask you, Marty, why were the Cuban Five put in prison?
Well, in 1996, four planes from Cuba shot down Brothers to the Rescue planes. It's a right-wing group that operates in Miami and has over the years made intrusions to Cuban airspace, dropped things over Cuba, et cetera. In any event, at some point in time, after long negotiations between the Cuban government and the American government, where the American government said it would do everything to stop these flights, and clearly Washington intended to do that, but by the time the orders got down to Miami, they were ignored. So that these planes went up February 1996, and then they were shot down. They were shot down over Cuban airspace. At the trial, a jury concluded that the planes were shot down, in fact, over international waters, and they also concluded that the defendants in this case played some kind of role, various defendants played some kind of role in the shoot down. It was a 7-month case trial. It was a prosecution originally started under Clinton. It was finished under Bush, and it was at a time when both parties wanted to be very hard on, let's say, left-wing Cubans or Cuba itself by pressing this prosecution. Although the shoot-down is February 1996, and although the government had all the information it needed, it didn't arrest these defendants, or any of these defendants, until 2.5 years later. And the reason is that the politics of Miami, the politics of the 2000 election, required both, as they saw, both political parties, as they saw it, to be harder than hell on Cuba and people sympathetic to Cuba. There was a conviction, and at first the appellate court set aside the conviction. And Lenny Wineglass argued that brilliantly on the grounds that a motion for change of venue should have been granted. Ultimately, that's reversed by the 11th Circuit. And the Supreme Court denies cert. I get involved in the habeas corpus petition, and that's what we're talking about now.
And, of course, in addition to the shoot-down where the Cubans were defending their own airspace, there were terrorist actions launched from South Florida onto the island. In fact, when the Cubans were trying to develop their tourist business, there were terrorists from Miami that actually killed an Italian tourist in a hotel, blew him up, and numerous actions like that. So the Cubans were really just trying to defend themselves. And I remember Lenny telling me that they had compiled a huge dossier on these terrorists in Miami, and they turned that dossier over to the FBI on the assurance that the FBI would do something to stop those intrusions. And instead, the people that they were able to identify in the dossier as Cubans were then arrested, and those people are now your clients.
Right.
But I think the most egregious current development, and I'd like to ask you about it, is this whole business about the American government paying journalists to write slanted articles before and during the trial of the Cuban Five. And I wanted to ask you the details of that and what you're trying to do legally to get a reversal of the convictions.
Well, I'll discuss that briefly, which is presently before the Florida court. We're about to file other papers related to the NSA surveillance, which has been revealed recently, arising out of the Snowden revelations. And what I'm now telling you has not yet appeared anywhere else. What happened in this particular case, before we get to the journalism issue, is that the defense lawyers in the case, as they prepared the case itself, from the time they were appointed back in 1998 until the time of the conviction, and up until now, a whole bunch of defense lawyers, Lenny Wineglass leading the defense, these lawyers traveled back and forth to Cuba. And what we now understand is that, and this applies to you, this applies to anybody who goes to Cuba, anybody who goes to Cuba once you get into Cuba, you're picked up by the NSA surveillance. The NSA listening post on Cuba, the prime one, was at Sabina Seca in Puerto Rico, and it was made up largely of United States Navy personnel assigned to the Naval Security Group, which was the NSA's naval component. So they would get that information at that place and other places, take the information and send it throughout the United States, ultimately winding up at Fort Meade. So, for example, if I went down to Cuba in 1996 or 1997, they would pick up my name, they would pick up my phone number. If I had email communications, they would pick that up. And then when I came back to the United States, they would continue to monitor me. So if I were the defense lawyer then, which I wasn't, if I were the defense lawyer then, they would know when I called my client. They would overhear the client communications, whether it be done by phone or by email. They would then take that information and store it and listen to it and turn it over to both the FBI and ultimately the Department of Justice. Now, that's the motion we're about to file within the next 2 weeks. And the information that we have, and that had been FISA warrants originally in the case, which was used to secure the evidence against these, alleged evidence against these defendants. But no one at that time knew what we now know with respect to the revelations. Now, the Solicitor General, on October, about 6 weeks ago, admitted that there had been surveillance of cases where there were convictions, and that he was going to start to contact defense lawyers and others who either overheard or where convictions now should be reexamined. And they started to do this throughout the country in a few cases. Our case, of course, presents unique problems in that at that time, Cuba was designated terrorist state, and the allegations were made that the clients in this case were terrorists rather than people trying to protect their homeland. So it's a different case than many of the other cases. So the motion we're making now, filed, as I said, within the next 2 weeks, is to get the Solicitor General to respond in this case, as he has already indicated he had an obligation to respond in other cases.
That's really an explosive.
Right. Explosive thing. We have the details. I've gotten the details about the way information is intercepted, where it goes. To some extent, I mean, I have it. I've spoken to some people who had some familiarity with the government's surveillance practices. What we've learned is that, as you know, and some of your listeners may know, in 1975, the Church Committee said there were certain things the CIA could not do. And allegedly, or presumably, or at least the CIA said we were stopping it. What we now know is that the CIA budget, a large part of the NSA budget, which I think last year was $52 billion, is 25% of it is for the CIA. So what the CIA was doing under the umbrella of the NSA was doing exactly what they were doing before the Church Committee said they couldn't do it.
Wow.
What we also know is if two people go to Cuba who have nothing to do with politics or anything like that, but if in the course of the conversation they mention certain names or certain facts, let's assume they would have mentioned the name of my client, Gerardo Hernandez, then the government, based solely on that, then starts to monitor that person. So it's not just if a defense lawyer goes to Cuba. Really, it's fundamentally anybody who goes, because anybody who goes is going to mention certain things, because they have some degree of knowledgeability. So I think if you were to look at the number of people who have been back and forth to Cuba over the last decades, all of those people are in NSA databases.
That's really unbelievable.
Right. It's astonishing.
So we've got this fundamental violation of the rights of a person in America to have secure communications between themselves and their attorney. And that's the Sixth Amendment. That's inviolable.
Right.
And here they
right.
violated that. And now you're going to tell us about how they violated by corrupting journalists before and during the trial to write slanted articles.
What the government did in the NSA case and what they've done in the journalism issue is unprecedented and unique in American history. What the government did, starting with 1996, is they had journalists who worked, let's say, for the Miami Herald or CBS or local Spanish stations on the government payroll. And the stations or the newspapers that hired these journalists did not know that they were also getting monies from the government. And the Miami Herald or CBS or the Illinois Herald, various people who own these newspapers, never checked out the stories to see the similarities between the stories presented, let's say, on Radio Marti and then in the Miami Herald. In 2006, the Miami Herald found out about it, and there were a series of stories. The defendants didn't know anything about this at the time of the trial. In 2006, the Miami Herald learned about it, and in a series of front-page stories, fired the journalists who were involved, pointed out how much money they got. One journalist got $286,000. There were substantial amounts of money spread in substantial amounts of places. What the government also did during the course of the trial, Radio Marti is allowed, just like the Voice of America, is allowed to, in certain areas, overseas, give any government propaganda, more or less, that the government wants to do. And Radio Marti has the right, under the American structure, to say whatever they want to say in Cuba. But what they did at the time of the arrest and up until the conviction is the Radio Marti broadcasts were boomed into Miami and South Florida, the places where the jurors came from. And although there was a gag order in the case, which precluded the defense lawyers, precluded various representatives from saying anything to the media, what the judge did not know is that at the same time that gag order was supposed to be stopping the government, that there were these dozens and dozens of journalists out there who were doing a certain kind of propaganda that you have to see. Now, many of the journalists were hired after this case was started. Many of the journalists, which were handpicked, many of them by the American government, were Bay of Pigs veterans, Operation Mongoose veterans. These were the same people who had been jailed, both in Cuba and in the United States, for terrorist activities. So it was not just legitimate journalists who got money, but they put on these other people who had never written a sentence in their lives. And there was some mill, which was then just turning out information, which was being given. Because if you look at the Radio Marti stories and you look at the Miami Herald stories, you have the same sentences, the same paragraphs, and it's clear that it's coming out of a central cookie cutter.
We have to underline the fact that it's illegal for Radio Marti or Voice of America, for that matter, to broadcast propaganda inside of the United States.
Yes.
They're not supposed to do that.
Right.
Otherwise, you have a democracy turned on its head.
Yes. And the Radio Marti budget was $15 million a year. Radio Marti has always been a sore spot. Congress has always been asking where the money spent, how the money spent. We've gotten into it here to see where the money goes. A lot of people on the payroll of Radio Marti, not surprisingly, were right-wing Cubans who were involved in many ways in the prosecution of this case. As I said before, there's a group called Brothers to the Rescue. It was their planes, their two planes that were shot down. Brothers to the Rescue was all over this prosecution. And we believe that, tying this now to the NSA claim, that the Brothers to the Rescue team, Basulto, Carillas, other people who were working with the FBI in order to get this prosecution had the benefit of the overheard material, and that these people, Basulto and others, Pesquera, who was then the head of the FBI in Miami, all overheard or had access to the information that was overheard, this attorney-client protected information.
Just unbelievable.
Right.
Well, Marty Garbus, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
You.
We want to keep talking to you about this as the story unfolds, and we congratulate you for stepping so ably into Len Wineglass's combat boots. And keep up the good work, Marty. Thank you so much.
I can only step into them. I can't fill them. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
course of events that led to NATO's intervention in Libya is analyzed by our guest Horace Campbell in his recently published book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya, Lessons for Africa in the Forging of African Unity. Professor Campbell traces the origin of the Libyan conflict in the context of the Arab Spring uprisings and argues NATO was used by North American and European imperial forces to impose its political will on the rest of North Africa. This NATO campaign caused upwards of 50,000 civilian deaths, destroyed Libya's infrastructure, and left the country in chaos. We talk with Professor Campbell about this and about American designs in general on the African continent.
Professor Campbell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
What's the name?
Law and Disorder. Because we can't decide about the rule of law doesn't necessarily always work in the right direction. So sometimes
we know that the law of the Wall Street is creating disorder.
Precisely.
I think that's a very good way to say it.
Yes.
We're talking to you at a late hour in Beijing, China, and we really appreciate your being with us. The book we're talking about, but really the subject, is Libya, NATO, the West in Africa. The book I want to tell people is an extraordinary book. It's called Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya, Lessons for Africa in the Forging of African Unity, and it's by Professor Horace Campbell. I just want to highly recommend it because you don't get in this country at all the opinions that are put forth and the facts that are put forth in this book. So thank you for writing it, Professor Campbell, and we'll begin with the first question. You know, there were a lot of progressives, unfortunately, if they want to call themselves that, who supported the intervention in Libya. And it was one of the most disheartening few months I spent trying to convince people. And you take a position in this book that that intervention should not have happened. It was a NATO intervention. And you try and talk about what were some of the reasons it happened. So can you just give us your overview of that? And then, of course, in the context of the Arab Spring as well as NATO.
Well, the revolutionary upheavals that took place in Tunisia and Egypt have had great implications for all societies in this region. Libya, which has been underdeveloped politically, was a place where the Western powers manipulated what was supposed to be an incipient uprising in the Benghazi, militarized it, and turned it into a base for the destabilization of all of North Africa. And today, as we speak, they continue to manipulate what is going on in the Libyan society. The book is called Global NATO because Global NATO is an attempt by the governments of the North Atlantic region, namely the United States Capitalist Center and its Western European allies, to internationalize the basis for military interventions by this NATO. NATO was created as a Cold War instrument with the mandate to defend Western Europe. Usually, when such an alliance is created, if the ostensive reason for the alliance goes away, and in this case, the ostensive reason was the rise of the Soviet Union, then one would have expected that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO would have been wound up. Instead, after 1991, the forces behind NATO have sought to expand its reach. So today we've seen NATO being deployed in Afghanistan, and NATO is in alliance with countries such as the most conservative elements in the Middle East, called the Gulf Cooperation Council. And so we have had an attempt by the Wall Street elements to use NATO as the instrument for the United States military management of the international system. So
so that today when the dollar is not backed by gold or backed by the economic stability of the United States, the dollar and the United States economy is backed by global NATO and the military management of the international system. It is in that context that we have to understand the projection of force in Libya. Many progressives would have been confounded by what was going on in Libya because Muammar Gaddafi was not a progressive. And because he was not a progressive, many would say, yes, good for NATO to intervene. But a sophisticated understanding of why NATO was intervening to control the resources of Libya, to destabilize North Africa, to stop the African Union project, and to create confusion by supporting the same Al-Qaeda elements that they're supposed to fighting a war on terror. These were the reasons why the left and the peace movement should have opposed the NATO intervention. And so the book is written as a matter of urgency to clarify to the peace and justice movement that we have to have a level of sophistication when we deal with the Middle East and North Africa. And just as in Syria and in the case of Iran, there is confusion among the left and the progressive forces about what's going on. And so the Libyan intervention was serving as a springboard to re-galvanize the progressive and peace forces in the United States and in the world.
No, I think that's really an important message. It's one that a lot of American progressives just don't know. It's why I think your book, A Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya, is so important. Let me ask you a question about Libya, because the UN resolutions, which you address in the book, you address many subjects, the execution of Gaddafi, the role of U.S. corporations, etc. But on this particular issue, I have friends who are in the, quote, human rights movement, not necessarily progressive, who say, well, there was a duty to protect and there was going to be a genocide in Libya, and therefore we had to use these resolutions, which you discuss in your book, 1970 and 1973, as resolutions on duty to protect for humanitarian intervention. Now, that, of course, is a way in which often U.S. imperial power intervenes in countries under that guise. But I think a lot of people were tricked by that in some way. And in addressing that, can you also mention, because it was a blow to us when both China and Russia, I think they abstained rather than veto. If you can put it in some context in that way.
Yes, I think this is simply cynicism, and it depends on the political illiteracy of the citizens of North America. But it's cynicism because with all of the atrocities going on in Palestine, against the Palestinian people, one would have expected, if there was any place you needed a UN resolution on responsibility to protect, it was in Palestine, where the Israeli occupation and the Israeli desecration of the lives and communities of the Palestinian people require international intervention and daily discussion. But what we saw in Libya was, in my view, this kind of manipulation using the media, using cognitive tools that touches the heart of people about intended massacres in Benghazi. Now, the UN resolution was passed because Gaddafi was supposed to be about to kill Libyans. And yet, what we now need is an investigation in the fact that NATO killed more than 50,000 persons, and the responsibility to protect does not extend to black-skinned Libyans of Tuwerga, over 30,000 who have been driven from their communities. So this is just simply cynicism, because up to now we need a resolution of responsibility to protect inside of Libya, to protect from the forces of NATO, and to protect the Libyan people from the militias that have been unleashed by Al-Qaeda, supported by the CIA and NATO. So this is simply cynicism. On the question of whether China and Russia abstained in this resolution, the Chinese justify on the basis that the African members of the Security Council at that time, mainly South Africa, abstained. Now, the fact is that President Obama exercised intense pressure on the South African presidents, on other presidents. I think he actually telephoned directly for them to vote for this resolution of responsibility to protect. So I don't think we should use this as any basis to say this was a legitimate action of the United Nations, because, in fact, the matter of Libya is not over. Last week, there was a Senate investigation committee by the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate about can Washington prevent Libya's downward spiral. In other words, the same NATO that created the problem in Libya, the same United States, France, and Britain, is now seeking the support of Congress to go into Libya, into the same place that they created the problem. So they created a mess, and now they're presenting themselves as those who are to clean up the mess. And again, I'm glad you're doing this program, because there's not enough discussion going on among the peace and progressive forces, so that we should be saying to the senators from New York, both Democratic senators, that the United States of America should be going to the United Nations to say we should be investigating the atrocities that were carried out by NATO in Libya. And as we can see in the case of Benghazi, the fact is that the Central Intelligence Agency was using the very same Salafist and the conservative fundamentalist to fight a war in Syria. So all this has blown up in the face of the establishment. But because the left and the peace movement is not engaged in this question, then the right wing of the United States, Lindsey Graham, and those in the Senate can continue to use Benghazi as a whipping tool to support the conservative military. So I'm very happy you're doing this program, because more people need to read this book and need to know what went down in Benghazi.
We're speaking to Professor Campbell, author of an amazing book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. A very important book, I think, for every listener here. It's not just about Libya. It's about NATO domination of the world through NATO. Michael?
Professor Campbell, you mentioned before, and I wanted you to elaborate on the point you made about U.S. designs on the continent of Africa.
Yes. The U.S. designs on the continent of Africa is actually quite confused at the moment. It's confused because of the assertiveness of the African Union and the assertiveness of the African peoples and those within the progressive community in the United States of America that have opposed the principal instrument of the U.S. foreign policy in Africa, that is the U.S. Africa Command. During the Bush administration, the United States presented itself as going into Africa because there were three main threats as they understood it. One was the global war on terror, and that there were terrorists using Somalia and Mali and Nigeria as a base for terrorism. Two, because United States oil was of strategic interest to the United States. And three, because China was challenging United States interests in Africa. These three reasons that were proposed by the Bush administration have now been overtaken by a number of events. Number one, it turns out, as we've seen in Libya, that it's the United States and the Western forces that are supporting the jihadists who are called terrorists. And we have seen in a place like Somalia, where the African peoples themselves, through the African Union, have been able to bring some stability to Somalia. So there's no legitimation for the U.S. Africa Command. Secondly, the United States can no longer claim that African oil is of strategic importance to the United States, because it is now presented to the American people that the United States is now self-sufficient in fossil fuels, and that by 2015, the United States will become the number one exporter and provider of fossil fuels. And number three, the administration of Obama is cooperating now with China in Africa. So the reasons for the United States Africa Command have been overtaken by events. And that is why the progressive forces in the United States should be calling for the disbandment of the United States Africa Command, because the establishment of this command is to foment instability in Africa and to provide a basis for United States private military contractors. What has happened is that with the winding down of the war in Iraq and the impending winding down of the war in Afghanistan, United States private military contractors, which is an arm of the Pentagon, who goes through the revolving door for generals, they are setting up the basis for destroying and destabilizing Africa. So we need the peace movement and for the progressive forces to be calling for Congress and for the United Nations to have better monitoring of private military contractions. There's no international body that monitors the work of private military contractors. And so the United States design, and I would say the corporate elements of the United States, because there are many sectors of the United States in the peace and justice community, in people in health, people in education, who support the African peoples. We're talking about the conservative forces, the religious fundamentalists, and the right-wing forces. We need to undermine their work in Africa, which is trying to destabilize Africa.
We're speaking with Professor Campbell, author of an amazing book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. When we began this discussion with you, you talked about the intervention in Libya sort of, as I think I heard it right, as a stepping stone for the intervention in Syria and in Iran. Can you explore that context a little bit with us?
Yes. Before this week, when we've had this stepping back from the brink with Iran, as you know, the conservative forces in the United States of America believe that the way to solve the economic crisis in the United States is through war. And just this week, John Bolton, who was a former ambassador of the United States to the United Nations, have called for a war against Iran. For the past 10 years, the very right-wing and conservative forces said that there should be war with Iran, and because the same military management of the international system that I spoke about requires that the United States is perpetually at war, because that is needed so that the high military expenditures that comes out of Congress is perpetuated. Now the peace movement should be calling for reduction of the military budget. So in order to keep that military machine going, there was plans for war in Iran. Now, in order to get to that plan for war in Iran, there was the support for the most conservative jihadist in Syria. Now, I think here again is a case such as that of Libya, where sophistication is needed, because the progressive forces have no truck for the Assad regime. But what happened in Syria in 2011 was that the legitimate non-military opposition forces to the Assad regime, these were isolated by the conservative jihadists supported by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the conservative Wahhabists. And so we have a situation in Syria where Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar are in alliance with the Al-Qaeda elements. Now, what the situation? The United States is telling its citizens that it is in a war on terror against Al-Qaeda, and yet the CIA was financing the very same Al-Qaeda. In the case of Libya, General Petraeus was using Benghazi as a base to recruit conservative Islamic fundamentalists from Libya to go to Syria to fight. So here's a web of conspiracy of the military, of Israel, of Saudi Arabia, and the CIA fomenting instability all across North Africa and the Middle East. And what blew up in the faces of the militaries that led to the downfall of Petraeus was this case on Benghazi, where the very same jihadists that they were financing, they fell out with them and they killed each other, and the ambassador of the United States to Libya, Christopher Stevens, was caught in the middle when the United States presented to its people that it had a consulate in Benghazi. There was no such thing as a consulate. There was no embassy in Benghazi. This was a CIA facility that was being used to support Al-Qaeda elements. And all of this is being hidden from the citizens of the United States by how the media is spinning the matter. As I've seen from the press, reading from here, I've seen that even the CBS, 60 Minutes, their producers are falling prey to this manipulation of news, so that it was so obscene that they had to release one of their journalists who was involved in this manipulation of information. And this is why the peace movement has to be more on the top of the situation to understand the manipulation by the CIA and the conservative militarists in the United States of America.
Well, Professor Campbell, that's a really important statement. Michael Smith?
This is not exactly on topic, but it's something that's central to the news now. I wondered whether you could reflect on the Iranian situation and how the Israelis are so unhappy with the Obama-John Kerry agreement with Iran, and how the Israelis and their supporters here in the United States are trying to undermine that. What is your take on that?
Well, I think we should be careful when we speak about the Israelis, because we have to separate the Israeli people who want peace, who want to live in peace with the Palestinians, and the conservative, the very right-wing reactionary forces around the Prime Minister of Israel, who is himself a white racist from the United States of America. So we have to separate the two, so that these white racist elements that constitute the Prime Ministership of Israel, along with the conservative forces of the United States, are very unhappy. And what we see now is an alliance between Israel, the conservative forces in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and the conservative forces in the United States. If there was any alliance that requires the new mobilization by the peace and left forces, this is an alliance. And so the progressive forces in Israel are waiting for the peace and justice movement in the United States of America to make a distinction between the Israeli semi-fascist leadership and the Israeli people, and to link up with them to say, we must settle the Palestinian question and we must enter into peace relations with Iran. And I think this is where the peace movement is broken down in the United States of America, because on the question of Israel, the peace movement has been compromised and cannot make a very clear statement about the atrocities carried out in Israel in the Middle East.
Professor Campbell, I want to really sort of end with a last question. I just want to announce your book again, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. My last question, although I want you to tell us when you're coming to the United States so we can put you on a lecture tour and how we get to your website as we finish. But my last question is Libya today, and you referred to it briefly in your comments. You're sort of implying it's the way the United States actually wants Libya today. Maybe I'm just stretching that, but what is going on in Libya today? What is the U.S. doing there?
Well, let me say first, I look forward to this book tour because I live in the United States. I'm only in China as a visiting professor. I'm teaching in Tsinghua University in Beijing for a semester, and I'll be back in January. So I look forward to being able to speak to communities all across the United States about the book. So let us discuss that some more in great detail.
Yes, we will, and we'll be in touch with Monthly Review, your publisher, who we, of course, know very well.
Good. On the question of Libya today, as I said, in Libya today, we have a situation where the society is in complete disarray. There are 1,300 or more militias who are running around the country. There's no law. There's no order. There's complete insecurity. In fact, the people of Tripoli demonstrated 2 weeks ago against these militias, and over 40 people were killed. So just on Sunday, John Kerry was meeting with the Prime Minister of Libya to talk about how the United States can intervene in Libya to assist this situation that they themselves created. And I think the left should be speaking out about this, that the matter should be before the United Nations, before the international community, that there should be an investigation about these militias and how do they get their support. The militias get their support from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Emirates, and the conservative allies of the United States of America. So the United States cannot say they're going back into Libya to stabilize the situation when they created the situation. These militias must be disarmed for the people of Libya to have some modicum of peace, because there's been no peace since 2011, where over 50,000 people have been killed by the allied forces of NATO. So I'm happy you're raising the question of this book, because we need to have real engagement so that the population of the United States does not continue to be manipulated by the extreme militarists who, in my view, want to use these instabilities to maintain the high budget of the Pentagon at a time when we should be demilitarizing the United States society.
Professor Campbell, we want to thank you. I know you're speaking to us past midnight in Beijing. But again, we've been speaking with Professor Horace Campbell, author of this remarkable book that every progressive and every American ought to read, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Professor Campbell.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.